Hello and welcome to Pedagogzilla, the pedagogic podcast with the pop culture core, coming at you based on when this is probably going to be published, not live, but from our perspective live. We're live and in the same place. We are alive from the Playful Learning Conference 2024, day three. Woo! Your host, Riggedy Diggedy Mike Collins. I am a senior learning designer at the Open University. I'm imposter syndrome incarnate. I am a man with a big, bald, wet head because it's quite wet outside. And I am joined at the table by...
Lynn Pilkington. I went to a session yesterday on developing your professional identity. So who I am.
I am Lynn. I'm based in Glasgow. I've got a background in learning and development and education. I work part-time with children as a play worker. I also work for the government about accessibility of transport, and I do some training consulting for myself.
Fabulous, thank you.
And I'm Alex Mosley, and I've been here before. So I'm co-chair of Playful Learning, have been since the start, but this is my last year co-chairing.
Oh.
So it's both wonderful and sad all at the same time this year.
Wonderfully sad, Alex Mosley. And?
I'm just trying to decide what adverb and adjective describe my complex emotional states. Hello, I am Elliot Spaeth. It is, I think, my fourth time here, which is good because it is my favourite place in the world. And I am somebody that finds it difficult to describe myself, but I work for Advance HE, which is an organization that I find hard to define because it does lots of things. But my particular role is working with people, organizations, etc., to help them make their practice more inclusive, and in particular, to help them understand what that means in a way that aligns with their priorities, etc., etc. And I am particularly focused on doing that in relation to disability and neurodiversity, especially those that appear to be invisible. It's a shame you can't see the invisible air quotes I'm doing just there.
Well, we'll have a sound effect for invisible air quotes. It'll probably sound something like...
So, Cthulhu drowning. God, thank you.
Yeah, or a better sound effect. Dear Editor Mike, find a better sound effect than that. So we are coming together as it's the final day of Playful Learning and as it's Alex's final Playful Learning, at least as a
co-chair.
As a co-chair.
You are coming back, though, Rose.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you said it's your final...
Are you leaving the committee?
I'm coming back as a punter next year.
Are you leaving the committee?
Yeah. It's a hard drop. Yeah, basically, that's it. You're all in and they're all out. So I'm looking forward to giving lots of feedback next year.
Feedback isn't a weapon, Alex. Indeed. It's a gift.
But we, by sheer good fortune, happen to represent some different states of experience with Playful Learning. We have Lynn, it's your very first time, We have Elliot, fourth time. And then, of course, we have Alex, who was here when it was first forged from obsidian by the dwarves.
Indeed.
So it's a good opportunity, I think, just to talk about our various experiences with it, what we've been taking away from it in broad terms, how it might have influenced and changed us. And a little bit about the history of Playful Learning. And maybe that's actually a good place to start. So where did Playful Learning start? What happened to make all of this do?
Yeah, so there were two dwarves, giving your
two dwarves.
Interesting start to that now. Yeah, so it was forged by two dwarves on an airplane back from Ireland. So Mick Whitten and myself had been going to a number of different conferences around game design, playing games, education. Technology and education, and finding a very familiar pattern, which will be familiar to lots of people who've been to conferences, which is there's a fairly standard format. You tend to be in big lecture theatres, you tend to be talked at, you tend to see lots of slides, you tend to be rushed from one session through a coffee queue to another session. A coffee and the food tends to be a bit mediocre. You left your own device in the evening to try and find a bar that everybody else is at, and or there's a big sponsor who dominates your life and you have to drink their drinks and you have to buy their products.
I was going to say it's like all the worst parts of the wedding, but then that last bit doesn't fit so well.
No, not usually sponsored. It lives in my experience. It probably is done, isn't it?
Probably a cheaper way to do a wedding.
So we had all this in our head when we were coming back from one of those conferences. So we just got a bit of paper and we listed out all the things we didn't like about conferences. And then the opposite side of the sheet, we put the opposites. And we said, okay, if we were to design the unconference, that is a thing, an anti-conference, I guess, what would it be? And that's kind of how Playful Learning started. So we, as people who've been to Playful Learning see, we don't have sponsorship of any kind. We want to stay independent. We don't want to sit people through sponsor messages and all the rest of it.
Who would sponsor Playful Learning?
To design our own drinks.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah, like a brewer. I suppose a brewer could.
Lego?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, Lego. Yeah, they do run out of this, don't they? Lots of Legos.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of people that apply to do sessions, some of whom are people who have products, etc.
But then they're told they can't deliberately advertise in those sessions.
Interesting.
So, but then we also think one of the other things we didn't like about conferences is you parachute into Berlin or Cork or Manchester and you never see it. You never see the city unless you have to walk from your hotel to the conference and back, or if you have a friend there, if you're so lucky. So we also wanted to make sure that we embed within the city. So one of the things we definitely wanted to do is work with the place closely. So work with the university, with the catering team, with the porters and cleaners for the local place, but also look at the local community, other community groups that do play that we want to work with or that are different and actually just have something to bring, and other places we can go in the city. And what's been brilliant over the history of Playful Learning is we've been to 3 places so far. We liked the idea of staying in one place for a few years and then moving on to get a different experience. So in Manchester, we set a pattern which has followed since, which is the first year we tend to stay pretty much in the university, and we work with the local team to try and get the catering. It's a vegetarian-owned conference, another thing that we didn't like about the usual fare. So we work with them to get that catering right. We work with the venue to find the right spaces to operate in, and we see what other facilities are around to support the conference. And then we learn from that. And next year it will be bigger and reach further. And the final year will probably be on the seafront, which is kind of the way it's gone the last 3 years. And we'll spend more of our time away from the venue than we do at the venue because we've found so many local connections. So,
well, it will involve that board game cafe that a load of people ended up at last night.
I feel that might feature next year.
So, Playful Learning. So that's the history. So obviously, first couple of years at Manchester and then...
Yeah, 3 years at Manchester, 3 years at Leicester. And that, again, that had the same sort of thing. We built up... We were interrupted, of course, at Leicester by, you know...
COVID.
That thing. And so we did have a pseudo Playful Learning in the middle of that. So there was an online Playful Learning in the midst of the pandemic that wasn't quite the same as a real Playful Learning, but it kind of worked, you know. So that was a half a Playful Learning. So we've done 7.5, we think, to date. And then the year back, which was an interesting one, we effectively did 3 conferences in one. We did a 2020, 2021 and 2022 conference on one day each.
And that was my first one. That was awesome. That was intense and awesome in equal measures. I suppose because we've some accidentally going through this in actual like chronological narrative order, Elliot Lynn, how did you find out about it? How does one suddenly plug into the Playful Zeitgeist?
Elon traveling one, was that right?
No, that was where I was keynote.
That's right. That's where I started. Yes.
I didn't start, but I did start. Love it. And no, my first one was the year before that, but actually I'd been trying to come to Playful Learning for ages, but insert pause for diplomatic wording here. Nobody would let me come from where I was working. How did I actually manage to get to come the first time? I think it was a different job. So yeah, I asked and I got to come and it was great. And because I was specifically looking for things that I thought were relevant, I used to work more in learning technology type stuff. Like I was really just interested in ways of doing things differently. I guess my approach to conceptualizing play, because I love a conceptualization, is slightly different to what a lot of people think about when they think about Playful Learning, I think, in that people think about things which are great, which is like, you know, like Lego and making things and crafts and like dancing outside and doing things that are like very like visibly artistic, or like taking you back to the kind of play that we don't really get encouraged to do as adults, but we do as children. And I think that's all wonderful and really important. And I think that for me, at the base of it, it's about like being playful with societal norms, for example, and not doing things because that just seems to be the thing. But actually, like, everything being possible, like the good old Assassin's Creed motto, if everything is possible, then you've got much more scope from which to decide what to do. And I think that's really important for inclusion. So, yeah, I don't even know what it was that I Googled. But yeah, somehow I found the website with all the Pac-Man stuff on it. Yeah, I am.
For copyright reasons, it's a vague approximation.
Sorry.
It looks a bit like Pac-Man.
But what I mean is the Pac-Man.
Pikmon.
I almost refuse to go to any other conference now.
So, Lynn, this is your very first time here. It's also actually your first time on the podcast because we've had both Alex and Elliot on before. So I guess could you just tell us about your, you know, where you're coming from, kind of like in a both sort of personal and professional sense, and also how the hell you became aware of playful learning.
How I became aware, I have no idea, like Elliot. I've known about it for a while and been committed to trying going. But
because we were already on LinkedIn.
We were
already with each other.
From something. So in the inclusion space in Scotland, it's and higher and further education. It's all those general good things, which are themes which go out throughout my life. And I suppose my experience of my first time being here is that so I do this stuff naturally in what I do. It's nice to come out my echo chamber to see how novel, I suppose, these approaches are to other people. I have a scrapbook of student engagement, which I've done for 10 years when I've been National Union of Student or in higher and further education, going out on campus and doing right on the society's washing line or let's do housing cardboard cutouts and get out on campus. Like that's my ethos, taking tricky policy concepts and turning them into creative, fun ways to engage people. I can speak policy, but the way you involve people is light them up, you make it playful. That's, I edutain people, I educate while entertaining them, right? So my fascination is combining improv with psychological safety, Palladius's courses about mental health, doing that. So that's my juxtaposition, my normal. And
I mean, the juxtaposition of hilarious courses about mental health. I want to go on one of these courses.
The most
I
funny course about suicide, right?
The funniest, you heard it.
You get people. So yeah, like in one of the institutions, I was on the senior leadership level running mental health first aid. And somebody, one of the leaders, like, what's going on in there? It sounds hilarious. I was like, oh, we're talking about suicide. Like, but that's how we get people to feel comfortable. And I'm not making fun of people, but by dripping anecdotes in things or by sharing your personal experience, if we're generally sharing fidget toys and colouring in, we embrace that culture of being like, this is an okay thing to talk about. Yeah.
Oh, no, I was just putting my hand up to, like to glow you up, to say, like I know that, like, some listeners might think, wait a minute, like, it's not a trivial, you know, it's not a trivial thing. And I think that the thing that's so important is if someone's laughing, it means they find a way to connect with it. And so that's why, like, it's so impressive.
Oh, for sure.
That you do what you do.
Like, I've always found a way, it's a way to connect people on a similar level. And I suppose I've lived and breathed inclusion stuff. And that's where my career has been focused. My own kind of experiences weren't really mainstream, and I really struggled to fit in. And I take that experience of being sensitive to those on the outside and think, how do we fit them into mainstream spaces? How do we make them feel this is where they belong? And a lot of that, yesterday was at a workshop about identity, and we all had things in our labels on our backs of people that people wouldn't want to work with, like a disgruntled colleague or a snobbish lecturer. And I found all the people that everyone was rejecting and was like, you belong here. No one else wants us. You belong in our tribe. How many were here? And again, somebody's like, I didn't find anyone. I was like, over here. And she comes over. I'm like, welcome. And for me, that experience, it takes conscious effort, right? So being sensitive to that. So finding that, and I suppose my observations around, like, first time being here, but I didn't expect it to be, there's quite a lot of, yeah, it makes sense, learning and teaching academic sort of form to it. And when I work part-time with children, this is my normal. I do outdoor yoga with kids. We do chalking. I'm literally like a Blue Peter presenter. I do crafts every day. And what I love about children is bringing that curiosity, that why not me, that can I join in? Lynn, can I help? Why not do this? And then you bring that to adults and they forget that that's a childlike wonder we can approach these kind of topics.
It's kind of like a sort of a combined kind of energy and sort of recontextualization.
Totally. So this is the thing I don't get my head around. When I'm going about and people are talking about, I want to embed this in my professional identity, I don't need people to give me permission to be playful. Are people waiting for that? It's like, do people, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay. So I think there's two things. I think there's structural universities thing. And I think there's a, like, I don't want to be reductive, but like, I think there's probably like a neurotype thing. I think that heuristics are a big thing. So like mental shortcuts, there's just, I think people make a lot of assumptions that X means Y and don't always interrogate all the bits in the middle, which is a very like sensible, like evolutionary way of doing things. It's just, I don't think my brain does that very often. And so I'm always making a lot of decisions manually, which means I'm overwhelmed and exhausted. And that doesn't, I'm not saying that's better. It just means that I'm sort of always critically questioning like most things. And a lot of people, I think they've managed to build an algorithm internally where that's not done. And so,
oh, yeah, that's such a new thing.
But then also, like with universities, I think, so I'm somebody that's like you, like I'm naturally very playful. The way that I do things is like that. And yet there's these narratives that things have to be done a certain way. And it's not so much about like your personality, but it's like, oh, but like, it's a, like there's this, the words appropriate and professional are used to kind of gaslight people that are in touch with their playful side. Like I once did a talk during my PhD, which was on music listening for anxiety disorders. And like people were laughing because I wasn't laughing about anxiety disorders. I was making a joke about being scared of a table, which is a reasonable thing to be scared of if you are. But one of the pieces of feedback I got, like, was not, oh, it was so great that you got people engaged after lunch. Mm-hmm. It was, I think, if you want to be taken seriously as an academic, you'll need to be a bit more somber. I wrote a blog post, which ended up going in Times Higher Ed. There's this idea that, like, if you think about the imposter syndrome, or, to be nicer to ourselves, trespasser syndrome, because the environment makes us feel like we don't.
There's definitely a modelled behaviour, because I think imposter syndrome in just the education field is endemic. And I think a lot of people don't speak about it because it's very exposing. And then you get people who find themselves, in order to essentially combat imposter syndrome, they try and fit in. So to not be an imposter, you try and fit in, try and perform, and you mimic the behaviours of people around you and the context.
The big open secret is that everyone's...
That's everyone exactly the thing.
You see to first-year student, everyone has imposter syndrome.
I don't think that's true. I think people at every level have it. I don't think everyone has it.
That's what I meant.
Yeah,
yes.
Imposter syndrome. And I think, you know, there are some people who don't have imposter syndrome who probably should. But that's a different kettle of fish. And then, I mean, for me personally, it's realizing actually that I don't need to ask permission. If anything, yes. It's not that I need to permission from somebody in order to, you know, be a bit more myself, who is a bit of a goof and makes strange noises. This is a very shared experience. And I'm surrounded by people who, and this is that change of context, who are exhibiting the behaviors that are actually much more authentic to me and are titans in their field. They bestride the world on legs of steel.
Can I come in on that?
You absolutely can. Good God, come in. I'd like to tail this ramble off.
I'm creative and engaging people because it works. Like, this is the thing that I'm just going to challenge on its head, right? In that, so someone once said, I'm the hall pass for other people to have permission to be themselves. I don't, like, through how I'm made, I show up as myself and I bring that and I sit on the floor with Sharpies and I've got the ideas. I'm not doing that because it's easy. And I'm not doing creative techniques with students because it's the first thing that comes into my head. I take time to cultivate playful practice. It's why I get results. So when people sit and say, it's not professional, or what, I'm very professional. It's a business case. I'm very good at what I do. That's an investment. So the bit for me is we spend a lot of time talking about being psychologically safe in institutions. Psychological safety is giving people the permission to ask questions and be themselves. Yeah. So as a facilitator, I encourage people to do that. That's my privilege, as being, I suppose, independent and out with that. But it's just so curious to me that people are forming these norms that keep me in a job to come in and facilitate them to get back to that state of, let's be curious. But yeah, I do find it, it's very easy to be boring, right? And that if you send an all-staff email, cool. If you send one with images and puns and have one-to-one conversations and go out on campus with a reward, and if you open this with this link, that's hard work. But that's why it works. It's why people smile at you. It's why they know who you are, because you make those purposeful connections. So Yeah, I suppose that's where, Elliot, you are. Come in.
Yeah, and I feel like it's funny, like, listening to you say that, I'm like, you know, when somebody says something that you hadn't thought out, like, consciously before, but you realise it's been in your head the whole time, like, what you said about you do it because it works, and I just thought, oh my God, people don't understand that, do they? Like, because I'm the same, like, the things that I do, like, I'm sitting cross-legged right now, people will say, but that's not professional, and I guess a lot of my professional work is informed by many things, including rage, that me doing the thing that actually, arguably, is making me perform in with the outcomes that they want is something that they will criticize as not being appropriate or professional.
For the outcomes, we are in a world which we are revolutionizing how we learn, how we work. If on an outcomes-based model, show you're working, my working's probably much harder than other people's, but it will give outcomes. And even not to say, I guess there's a place for play as the process, and sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes, like, I'm not 100% success rate, right? But for that,
it's a legitimate part of the toolkit.
Right.
As a practitioner, it's a legitimate part of the toolkit. There is evidence, it functions, it's not frivolous.
And everybody here knows that, you know, their practice in their institution, their playful practice, is going to give the students, the adults, the practitioners they're working with a much better, more engaged experience and a better learning journey than their colleagues who are doing the same thing that has been done for the last 20 years. And that's the hidden story into the outside world, but the shared story in playful learning.
I think, like, when you talk about results, I think the problem is other people believing, because people that don't get this, no matter what the data, you know, can be interpreted in any way. And if people don't want to, like, it's the stories that make, it's the narratives that make sense.
I come from a place where it's not, for me, a them and us situation. I am privileged in that I am white, I am educated, I come from a family of traditional professions. I often get what the institutional points are. I think there's a lot of people who have earned positions of power and privilege who have got there through a lot of either hard work or, yeah, luck, but that's not their fault. And I think we're at risk of, like, it should be a psychologically safe place for these others, whatever position that you're in. Right? And I think for me, it's not like you're some sort of off rogue rebel. Like, not at all. Come on in if you don't understand and you're in a position to change that.
It's not a cult.
It's not. Like, I think, like, how would I explain this to my dad? If my dad gets this, if I can make that point, then I understand, then other people will get it. A vice president, a lecturer, a finance person.
So I have a question for both of you, actually, because I there's a bit of a change, I think. So traditionally, in all the playful learnings before, it's been about people finding allies. So it's people who are on their own in institutions, in the way that you've described, trying to spread that. So basically, self-evidence the fact that what you're doing is legitimate and of value, but finding allies in other places, and often those allies you connect at playful learning and then keep connections with to keep that strong. But we're starting to see people who are now going to their institutions and saying, actually, there's a different way of doing this, and going positively in and saying, this is the way I work and this is my approach. I'm bringing play into this space, and people are recruiting them and or trusting them to do that. And that we've seen a bit of a change. And I suspect that in both your cases, given your stories, that's been part of your history as well, certainly mine. So that's where I am now. I got that on being openly play, as it were.
I think it's really interesting because I think when I work with external organizations, like, it's like they get it. But when it's an internal thing, it's much more difficult to get somebody to accept that somebody who works in their own organization.
I think one final point for me, the simultaneous though between we're looking at student engagement and results and the future of blended learning, and asking, what does this look like, saying we don't have answers? Hey, over here, we have ideas which we know work and are different. We were always prepared for this. You should probably listen to that.
We've been putting beans and distilled water down in the basement for years.
I mean, and that's
the engagement apocalypse.
Right. When we went online, I was like, oh, I am my own business case here. This is the... And I think for me, what's been evident, if you're used to facing barriers, if you're used to not being included, I spend my life translating how I'm meant to be in situations.
Yes.
That comes naturally to me.
Yes.
So it's not an extra effort. So of course I do that to think about how other people are reached and do that for other people. I forget, no through fault of their own, if you've not faced those barriers, there's assumptions, there's privilege, there's other things, then that's going to be a world away for them. So I'm almost like humbled and privileged by my barriers, because that's what informs what I do and that's what I have to do.
That's such a delightfully positive way of
life. Yeah, I really want to learn. So, like, I look forward to a long future of learning from and collaborating with you, Lynn, because I feel like, I just feel like you're so positive. And I've been saying similar things in my, well, out loud and in my brain, but in a very frustrated way. Like, I know this. This is literally what I do. You say you want solutions to this. So, like, and like when I do external work, that's what people want to hear. And I'm not talking about my current organization at the moment. I just mean generally when one's internally, like when one is in an organization, it can be like, but you've got people in the organization who are ready for this. That's what they do. And you don't want to hear it because you'd rather believe that you know the answers than be open to new things that will make things better.
But just remember, every single person's just a kid in a sandpit, trying to get everyone to play with them.
Well, and I will say it's not universal as well. I think, I mean, so I became a senior learning designer 18 months ago.
Thank you.
I'm a senior, I have a prefix now. But in large part, I think I managed to secure that because of the stuff I've done since coming to Playful Learning and the kind of the transformations that it's helped me make in how I approach practice. And, you know, I evidenced some of the stuff I'd done since there. And it helped me, it genuinely helped me the thing. And one of the things that came back from the, because when I was offered the job, I said, really? Because I didn't think I was suitable at all. But I said, and they said, well, one of the reasons why is because we think you've got a really good approach. Approach, by the way, I'm very much importing from Playful Learning. And we think that's going to work with what we're trying to do with these other teams. And it has, and it's helped so much. So I guess that's kind of an answer to that. Alex, I'm conscious of the questions being directed at me, but I'm on mic, so I couldn't help myself.
Your mic.
Lynn, do you have to go now?
I think so. I'll miss you, Lynn.
Okay, so Lynn has to leave us now, but that's absolutely fine. But Alex, we've been talking about playful learning up to this point, what people are getting from it. In fact, Lynn, can I get a final thought from you on the way past a microphone on your way out the door? Mm-hmm. A, where can people find you online if you would like to be found? And B, do you have anything you'd like to plug on your way out?
So I'm Lynn Pilkington, so I'm lynnpilkington.com. Like, hopefully if my search engine optimization is going well, you can Google my name and
there'll be a link in the
you'll
show.
You'll find my relevant links. Yeah, no, I'm not really good at plugging. I want people to plug me their event so I can go to more cool stuff. So yeah, just, yeah.
Send Lynn your cool stuff event. Thanks for joining us, Lynn.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a good train journey back. Safe trip, Lynn. We've been reflecting on the space Playful Learning, and I've just realised, by the way, that actually the perfect...
Lynn's struggling with the door. Yeah, that'll be a short pause.
That door is an absolute menace. We've been talking about sort of the history of playful learning, people's, obviously Lynn's first experience, Elliot's experiences, what we're drawing from it, and some of our big thoughts about that. I mean, Alex, this is your last year being co-chair of the conference. Just thinking back on the last few years, what have you drawn from it yourself? What have you got from chairing it? What are you looking forward to in not chairing it any longer and being able to hopefully participate, assuming you'd still like to come, of course?
I absolutely would, yeah. It's being aligned to my development so closely. What the thing I've got out from it, the thing that I think is the great value of Playful Learning, is it does exactly what you've just described, Mike, which is it allows people a space to legitimize their practice, to come along and find other people who they can work with and or just get support from in that practice. But it helps them tell a story because they'll hear somebody say, and this has happened so many times every year at Playful Learning, I'll hear somebody say, oh, I can write that for you. I can give you a senior fellowship quote. I can, you know, send you a bit of data about that.
I can review your book. That's fine. I'm reviewing your book.
Yeah. And so for loads of people, it's helped them to make that journey to legitimize their own practice, to find a space they can share that, but also to develop their own journey. And the number of people who have, since the start of Playful Learning to now, got better roles, better positions, leadership positions. We've now got, we didn't at the start, but the same people are coming to Playful Learning. We've now got Pro Vice Chancellors and Heads of Learning and Teaching and all sorts of other bits and pieces at Playful Learning. But the same people, they've just been through that journey. So the reflection, I think, is that it's given that space for people like us to develop in a community of practice over time. But also that it's been really, really, really good fun. really good fun. Elliot mentioned at the start that anything is possible, and that really is the tagline for the conference. Like we really do not say no to anything.
It is very much the conference where your abstract could be, I'm going to paint my arse purple and then scuttle across the stage like a crab.
Yeah.
And I think there's a pedagogic link. And they'd be like, cool, see you then.
Well, no, it's not quite true, because we are quite rigorous as well, actually. But if two other people...
Oh, no, sorry.
If that sounds like a good idea.
I know, sorry. If you had a good rationale for painting your ass purple...
If it was clear what other people, you know, would get out of it, if it was just watching you the whole time, maybe not.
Sometimes we have had a one-liner that literally says that, and then two other people have said, actually, that is intriguing enough for us to do it.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't a suggestion, by the way. Although, if somebody does want to do that as their... This is the challenge. Can somebody find that through?
Can you get a one-line article pass peer review? That's a good question.
Yeah.
This is probably the only conference you could do that, but you do have to be quite clever.
Yeah, because it is still academically rigorous.
Indeed.
And that's... I feel like it's like part of that whole, like, work needs to be awful. It's not work if you're having fun. Also, like, it's not valuable academically unless it comes with pain, sadness, and it almost breaks the academic system when... There's somewhere where you can do those things that are like terrifying parts of academia, like publishing and coming together for ideas and being valued and seen without going through that sort of weird trial by fire of the traditional approach.
Yeah, I mean, Mark and I published a paper through the Journal of Play and Adulthood off of the back of our first visit to the conference, and that was lovely. That was such a nice experience because I'm not an academically minded person at all. So the whole idea of submitting to a journal was horrendous, but that was really lovely. I mean, so you've given me sort of like the advertising pitch. What have you as a person drawn from, you know, from co-chairing Playful Learning for the last few years, for coming since the start? What?
I think it's just that free space to kind of go mad, to creatively experiment, basically. And we have had some really crazy ideas. And my favorite example of this, I think, is the year we did the pirate theme at Manchester. I would say it's one that's gone down in history, but they've all kind of gone down in history for different reasons. But the pirate one, I think, particularly brought everyone together on a common love. Pretty much everybody likes pirates. So for the pirate thing, Nick and I were developing the game. We have a game at Playful Learning. You'll know that if you've listened to this podcast before. We thought about the game 6 months in advance, as we often do. We developed the most complicated set of rules and you know, pirate jokes embedded and everything. You know, we had pages and pages of different things that were going to happen in this game. And then one meeting, Nick and I just said, actually, this is all nonsense. We threw it all out the window, and we said, why don't we just make a dice? And so we had six sides. We put a treasure chest on one, a parrot on another, and the requirement for the delegates was, this dice is for you to play the famous pirate game. There is no famous pirate game, but it generated probably about 50 or 60 famous pirate games. But also people used it to choose which session they were going to. It suddenly became a kind of playful, a tiny but really useful, playful tool that people then used throughout the conference to change their experience of the conference. So that's just a really nice example of a space where you can do all that experimenting and thinking and playing and trying something out.
So you've created your own playground.
Indeed. Yeah,
that's wonderful. Okay, so I've realized in the course of this conversation when this is going to be published, because I think this would be lovely when registration opens. There are two things I'd like us to tail off with. One would be a note to future or potential attendees. Why might you want to come to Playful Learning? And the other would be, what is your top tips for people who would like to submit an abstract or would like to submit a session to Playful Learning 2025?
So what are you trying to submit? I'll start with that one.
Yeah.
So tips for submission. What are you ashamed of? So I think what I'm trying to say from that is a lot of people look at Playful Learning and think they would really like me to run an escape room, or they'd really like me to come and do an outdoor workshop where I send them running around the fields if they've looked at any previous ones. But actually it's absolutely about what have you been doing for the last 5, 10, 15 years in your practice, which is a bit different and a bit secret and you don't tell your colleagues about it, but is playful and fun and gets your results, gets your students working. That'd be my advice, actually. Don't try and be the playful and thing you want to be the one you are.
I love that. Because it's like, don't try to conform to the non-conformist.
Exactly.
The ideal you think there is. Yeah, gosh. Yeah. Oh, that's so wonderfully meta. I love it. Because you're right. I can see myself, before I'd come to the conference, I would have mentally jumped through those hoops of, oh God, I've got to do it. Look at the previous programs. Okay, this seems to be the thing. I'll bring in the escape room. I'll take this thing. And rather than, oh, here's actually this weird, interesting thing that I've been doing. Fortunately, I know Mark. So Mark does our abstract writing. Elliot, any suggestions from yourself?
Yeah, I think for when it comes to writing like abstracts, for example, or applications to present, I think the thing that's really important is to throw out the idea of the usual convention of what is expected, because there's certain things that seem to be expected to be included in kind of academic abstract, whether or not it's particularly useful. And I don't really have anything in particular in mind, which is really unhelpful of me and very unclear. What I mean is, if we think about student-centered learning and the idea that that's about thinking about what the student would do and like having that constructive alignment or backward design approach, where we're thinking, okay, well, what is it that we want people to get out of this? And then how can we make that happen? That's what I'd really encourage, is to be thinking, okay, well, like, what do we want the audience or participants to get out of this, to experience? What are the things that we might want them to be thinking about in their own practice? And how can we do that? And how can we think about facilitating that in ways where, if we've decided on an approach that doesn't work for everyone, there's other ways that can do it. How can we do this in a way that gives people agency? Why was this interesting to you? What was the connection? What's exciting? Absolutely, if there's literature that you think is important and relevant, great, go for it. But the things that you think are important and interesting, those are probably the things that we think will be important and interesting.
So it's almost like a don't tie yourself in knots over the academic rigor side of things. While it's important, it's not everything. But also, don't forget that what's going to actually draw people in is the curiosity, it's the love, and it's the passion.
There's a path to rigor, and the first path to rigor is sharing that with colleagues and getting critical feedback on it, which is putting a session on a playful learning. Yeah, you can be right at the start of the process of gaining rigor in your practice.
But I'm using a session in here. I'm sorry, Abby Simon's not in the room, because we keep on saying rigor. So I'll just throw mine in. I know I didn't invite myself to, but I'm going to anyway. I'm going to throw mine in just as a person who doesn't write the abstract, as a person who reads them all, and likes to have a good shop around beforehand. Have a good title. Have a really catchy title that hopefully encapsulates kind of what people are going to get out of it in there. I'd also say, be really clear what people are going to come out of the session with. I'm a big fan, personally, if I see something that I can add to the old metacognitive toolkit and draw out of it, then that gives me the big chicken nugget yum-yums. It makes me extremely happy.
And we do actually try and be really clear on the application what it is that we're looking for. And every year we go through it again and think, have we been clear about that? Are there ways that it's been misunderstood where we could be clearer? So if there are things where you're like, honestly, you said you want this and I just don't really get what that means, we would love to know so that we can make it better and clearer and help you. Because I know how frustrating it is to think, okay, they said this, so I'll do this. And then it turns out they actually meant something different but never said so.
So that's our top tips. And you know what? I don't think we need a future thing. This has become kind of like a future note to people submitting for next year's conference. Alex, is there anything else you'd like to add as your final thought to add? Alex, next year you are participating as a human being, as Joe Public. What are you most looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to the food, because it's always better in the second year. Not that it's not been good. In fact, we had some amazing
fish
and chips last night, which was brilliant. So I'm looking forward to food. And I'm also looking forward to see what game is afoot, because that's a big part of playing.
And you won't be in the know, will you? It'll be all new to you. Oh, fabulous. Are you looking forward to sort of letting your hair down a bit and being able to kind of just sort of attend?
Totally.
Well, brilliant. In which case, I'm going to tail us off here. Thank you so much, Alex. Thank you so much, Elliot. Thank you, Lynn, in absentia, probably on a train right now. And by the way, would you like to be found online? Anything you'd like to plug?
I need to make myself more findable online. I am on both LinkedIn and Twitter, which I refuse to refer to as X.
Yep. It'll be Twitter again at some point.
So if you search my name, which is Elliot with two L's and two T's, Spaeth, which is SPAETH, then you will find me on there. Probably LinkedIn is the easiest place to find me, even though I am not particularly active. But then we can go from there.
Yep, salt over the shoulders for LinkedIn. Mm-hmm.
And I forgot to say at the start, so I'm based at Anglia Ruskin University. I'm head of learning and teaching there. So any combination of my name and that, you'll find me.
We love you lots. And we'll see you next time. In fact, we'll see you next year, both on Pedagogzilla and at Playful Learning 2025. Goodbye now.
Goodbye.
Bye.